computers, piles of paper, and silent phones. There are no criminals being led past him in cuffs, no shots being fired, no dramatic exchanges between the staff. It's just like any other government office, and Carl can't help feeling a little disappointed by this. He drums his hands on the desk.
"Go, Millie, go,"
he had said, and caused a distraction so she could get away. He's proud of himself for his quick thinking, but where will she go? What will she do? She's just a child, and he's sent her off into the suburban wilderness. He looks out the window. A mother walks past pushing a pram.
"I'll find you," Carl whispers.
The woman turns toward the window.
"Not you,"
he says quickly, feeling his face burn red. He shakes his head at himself when he realizes she could not have possibly heard. The woman disappears from view. He looks at the mannequin, whom he has named Manny, and who is propped up against the desk next to him.
"We'll find Millie, won't we, Manny?"
Carl is glad that Manny is here, that he isn't outnumbered, that he has someone on his side. Carl straightens Manny's shirt. He flicks Manny's trouser leg where his leg should be. He looks down at his own hands. His left index finger and both ring fingers end just above the knuckle. When he types with them now, they just stab at the air, reaching out for something they'll never find. He's taught himself to type with the stumps by dipping his wrists to make contact with the keys. He rubs his thumbs over them. The police officer who brought him here leans over the reception desk in the corner, talking in low tones to the receptionist. Gary is the officer's name. A full, thick body. Movements like a bulldog if it could stand upright. The receptionist is young, beautiful. She has long blonde hair, pink nails, and cool blue eyes with heavy black around the rims of them, like she has circled them with black marker, the way a teacher might circle an oft-repeated mistake. Gary flexes a bicep for her, pretending he's not doing it on purpose. But Carl knows he is doing it on purpose, as if he's bracing himself for an impact, about to be hip and shouldered from a running start. She trails her eyes up Gary's forearm, his bicep, his neck, and then finally to meet his eyes. Gary notices and grins triumphantly, as if he's won a race, a bet, at life. Carl turns away from them, pulls a pouch out of his pocket and empties it on the table. He found it in her bedside table drawer when he worked up the guts to start going through her things. A tag on it. "Carl," it said. Inside the pouch are 7 typewriter letters. F-I-G-T-R-O-O. She was trying to tell him something. He knows that much. He spends most of his days trying to work out what it is. He pushes the letters around in every configuration he can think of. Root. If G, fig root, grit of O, foot, erg, I forgot. He always ends up here.
Forgot what?
Forgot to turn off the stove, forgot to tell you that I had an affair with a very good-looking footballer once. Forgot that I have a huge gambling debt to pay off, forgot to tell you I'm not in love with you, not at all, that I never was. "So," Gary says, sitting down behind his desk. "What's that, then?" Carl sits up straight in his chair and sweeps the keys into his pockets.
"So,"
he says, "nothing." Gary fiddles with some papers on his desk, gathering them together in piles.
"Carl, is it?"
"Yes, sir,"
Carl says, his hands in his pockets tapping on his thighs.
"Why do you think you're here, Carl?"
"I've been arrested, sir."
"And why have you been arrested, Carl?"
"I'm not sure, Gary."
"I don't believe that at all, Carl. I think you're very sure as to why you've been arrested." Gary sits back in his chair.
"I think you'd have to be a bloody idiot to be unsure, and I don't think you're a bloody idiot."
Carl pauses.
"I wouldn't be so sure about that, Gary. I'm quite often an idiot."
"Look, Carl. Look," Gary leans forward, resting his elbows on the desk. "There's been some pretty serious allegations made against you."
"Allegations?"
Gary stretches forward to look over the desk.
What are you up to down there?
Carl's hands are still in his pockets, tapping away as he speaks. His fingers move up and down, underneath the fabric. Bugger, he knows how this looks. He pulls his hands out of his pockets, rests them on his thighs, and then thinks better of it, but doesn't know where to put them. He holds his arms out from his side like a child mimicking a rocket. Gary nods toward Manny.
What's he for, then?
He part of it?
It?
Yeah, it.
Gary writes something on a sheet of paper that sits atop one of his piles.
We'll need to swap the doll. And you, too, he says offhandedly.
A mannequin, Carl corrects.
He checks himself. Oh, I'm sorry, what? The receptionist approaches the desk with two glasses of water. Gary's eyes light up.
Perfect timing, sweetheart, he says, as he takes a glass from her and sips from it. Can you get the swap kit?
The girl plonks the other glass in front of Carl.
Cool, yeah, sure,
she says, giving Gary a brilliant smile, then turning around with a generous flick of her hair against her back. Gary watches her walk away for a good 5 seconds. And that's when Carl sees it. On the wall behind Gary's desk, a wall filled with posters of faces peering back at him. Some quite obviously their best faces, some quite obviously their worst. Wanted, some of them say. Missing, others say. One of them is, unmistakably, his own face. Missing, he is, not wanted, missing. He understands that and agrees. Gary holds up a piece of paper in Carl's line of sight. Carl tries to focus. He feels the drumming of his heart. He wipes his palms on his trousers.
What do you know about Warwick Vale Aged Care Facility? Gary's saying.
Carl recognizes the logo on the sheet of paper and his jaw tightens.
Oh, yes. Yes, what? It's an aged care facility.
Have you ever been there before, Carl?
No. No? I mean, yes. You mean yes? Well, yes. And no.
Gary puts the piece of paper on the desk between them. He slides his elbows onto the desk and links his hands together.
What the hell are you talking about, Carl?
Carl laughs. It's a high-pitched laugh. It doesn't sound like his laugh at all.
He clears his throat. I've visited there. You get to my age, everyone you know is in there.
The same high-pitched laugh that isn't his. Gary nods. Right. He stands.
Well, wait here, would you?
Carl nods, smiling, as Gary disappears into another room and closes the door behind him. Carl swivels his chair around and watches him through the window. Gary picks up a phone and dials. He notices Carl watching him. Carl waves and winks. Gary shuts the blinds.
Uh-oh, Manny, Carl says under his breath.
The receptionist click-clacks away on the computer.
Hi there,
Carl calls from across the room. She looks up.
Hi.
She says bluntly, not friendly, a snarl on her lips.
What would Branson Spike do? Nice place to work, he asks.
She ignores him.
How's the pay, all right?
She puts headphones in her ears and continues to type.
Plan B, Manny, Carl says, casting a quick glance at the receptionist to make sure she's not looking his way.
He picks up the glass of water and pours it on the crotch of his trousers.
Oh,
he says, standing and walking toward her.
Oh, she says, jumping out of her chair. Stop right there. What have you done?
Carl stops.
I seem to have had an accident,
he says, lifting his arms up so as to draw attention to the wet patch on his crotch.
Gross,
she says, screwing up her face.
Old people are so gross.
Carl shrugs.
Do you mind if I...
He points his thumb in the direction of the sign for the toilets.
Just go!
I'll swap trousers with him, he says, scooping Manny up under one arm.
I don't care, she says, taking deep breaths and sitting back in her chair. Just get away from me!
I'll be right back, Carl says.
The sign for the toilets points down the hall, to the right. The entrance is to the left. Carl glances back at the receptionist. She has her earphones in and her back turned. He smiles down at Manny, who looks up at Carl appreciatively.
"We're coming, Millie," Carl whispers, and heads toward the entrance.
Agatha Panther. 7:43. Picks up little girl. Walks to bus station with little girl. 7:53. A teenage boy walks past them on the street. He has braces and pimples and wears his hat sideways. "Probably thinking about masturbating," she says as they brush shoulders. "What?" he says back to her. He clutches a mobile phone to his ear like a life preserver. "What are you saying on that thing?" she says. "What do children have to say to other children? Fred, I didn't wet myself last night." The boy shakes his head. "You're crazy, lady," he says, as he turns and keeps walking. "In my day, teenagers didn't exist," she announces to his retreating back. "You were a child until you were two, and then you were an adult." She turns to the little girl and confirms, "He's the crazy one."
8:06. Arrives at bus station. "What's masturbating?" the little girl asks.
"It's what boys do to keep busy," Agatha says.
"What about girls?" the little girl says.
"What about girls? Boys touch themselves. Girls get themselves ready to be touched by boys. That's it. That's life. You should be writing this down."
8:07. Finds payphone in the station. Little girl rings mum. "Phone's still off," she says. 8:09. Purchases bus tickets.
"Two to Kalgoorlie," she says to the lady behind the counter.
"That'll be $64, the lady says.
"What?"
Agatha says.
$64, the lady repeats. "How much?"
Agatha says. $64, the lady says.
"You're paying me back,"
Agatha says to the little girl.
"I don't have any money," says the little girl.
"You'll get a job," Agatha says.
"I'm 7, the little girl says.
"Exactly," Agatha says.
"My dad died," the little girl says.
"We've been through this," Agatha says. "So did mine."
8:13. Looks around bus depot.
"Why are there so many drinks?" she says to the little girl.
There are 4 refrigerators pushed flush against the wall, filled with drinks ready to be purchased.
"In my day, there was a pint of milk, or 2 types of soda stream, yellow or black. Who knew what was in them? Black was a flavour, and that was good enough. Why are there 15 different types of water?"
She squints at the fridge.
"What on earth is vitamin water?"
The little girl shrugs.
"In my day, you were lucky to get a glass of water that didn't have sewage in it."
8:24. A blonde boy sits on the other side of Agatha and stares at her.
"What are you staring at?"
The blonde child is unmoved.
"Humans don't like to be stared at. Cats too. I found that out early. You should really be writing this down. Cats and humans don't like to be stared at. Get a pen."
8:36. There's an advertisement on the wall. A photo of a lady holding a sign that reads, "Old can wait." Agatha stands in front of it, as though they're facing off in a western. The blonde boy is still staring at Agatha.
"Old is not a choice," she yells at him.
The boy begins to cry, and his mother glares at Agatha.
"There's no point keeping it from him,"
Agatha says, and sits down again.
"Isn't that our bus?" the little girl says.
Through the window, Agatha can see a line of people filing onto a bus. "Kalgoorlie," it says on the front.
"Oh,"
Agatha says. She allows herself one deep, dark sigh.
Millie Bird. Sometimes, when Millie takes her gumboots for a walk through the park near her house, around the shops and down by the beach, she makes walking poems. She hears two words from the muscly couple running side by side. He said, and three words from the mum talking to her baby in the pram. Want your dummy? And a word from the elderly couple holding hands like they're holding each other up. Specifically. And then the silence from the girl not wearing much at all. But her sunglasses are the biggest thing on her body and she has music shoved in her ears and she's concentrating on moving the fat on her thighs to her boobs and the expression on her face. That concentration is part of the poem too. He said, want your dummy? Specifically. So now, as she walks through the bus, up and down the aisle, running her fingers along the seats, sliding her feet along the floor, she makes a poem. You like? Only 20. Married in a church? Oh my God! She likes how the words hit against each other sometimes. And other times, slide in next to each other so easily. The surprise of that. And she likes that it's a secret poem, even to her, because she won't remember it. And it will only exist for this moment. The bus is flying, trees and scrub and houses hurtling past them. The road ahead is long and straight. And the end of it looks as if you might fly off a cliff, into the sky, into space, into the universe, into nothing or something, or both. The sun flashes on the grass, making a colour across the sky like fire. And suddenly her stomach hurts. Everything hurts because she thinks of the night before the first day of waiting. So she sits down next to Agatha and tries to send her mum messages with her head. If she can detach her head to go into the past, why can't she detach her head so it will go other places too? She says, sorry, mum, sorry, mum, sorry, mum, sorry, mum, sorry, mum, in her head. The mum in the seat across from them breastfeeds her baby. The dad fusses over them. Millie's stomach pulls. She looks at Agatha.
Have you got a family, Agatha Panther?
Well, that's certainly none of your business.
Who's in charge of families?
Millie asks. What? Agatha says. Oh, the government, I guess.
Can you start one if you lose yours?
Just in case. You can't start a family. You're 4 years old.
7.
You have to get pregnant first. And 4-year-olds...
7.
Same thing. You can't get pregnant.
Why not?
You have to get your... Agatha gulps. Your monthly womanly visitor.
Are they from the government?
Good God, no.
Where from, then?
They're not from anywhere.
Why are they called visitors, then?
That's just what we say.
Who?
Agatha sighs loudly. Okay, I give up. Someone from the government comes to your house and makes you a woman. Millie eyes the breastfeeding mum and leans in close to Agatha.
Will they bring me my boobs too? She whispers. Because I'm not going to take them.
That's what you say now. You don't want them. Then you'll want them. And when you get to my age, when they're much longer than they are wide, you'll just wish you were dead. The dad opposite them leans over his wife. Would you keep it down, please? He says, pointing to the baby and putting a finger to his lips. No! Agatha yells. Oi! The bus driver says from the front of the bus. Pipe down back there! Agatha sits back in her seat and crosses her arms. Millie drums her fingers on the armrest.
What did you want to be when you grew up?
Millie whispers to Agatha. It doesn't matter. Agatha whispers back loudly.
Can I know?
Okay, I wanted to be taller. I wanted to be happier. I wanted to be a nurse. I wanted to have my own set of very good sherry glasses. Not the kind the Queen would use, but something very good. That's it. It wasn't much to wish for, but none of it happened. Life decides what happens, not you.
Did you want to get married?
Marriage is never something you want, it's something you do.
Millie fidgets in her seat. The bus driver keeps looking back at them in the mirror.
Did you and your husband love each other very much?
Millie whispers.
What is this, a talk show?
Will you be my dot four? She asks.
What? Shh, says the dad. Okay, okay, Agatha says. She's the crazy one, she adds, pointing to Millie. Just for the record.
Another fact Millie knows for sure. Even though there were all these words that existed, it didn't mean you could use them. But there wasn't a book on it. You were just supposed to know this somehow. Everyone else seemed to know but her. You could say some words, and you couldn't say other words. And that's the way life was. Examples of things you weren't allowed to say to anyone at any time. How fat are you? Do you have a vagina or a penis? What kind of funeral do you want when you die? One night, while her mum was on her hands and knees scrubbing the bathroom tiles, Millie said,
What kind of funeral would you like, Mum, when you die?
Her mum sat up like someone had yanked the back of her neck. Millie took a step back.
A balloon popped today at school and George cried and Claire laughed, but everyone was surprised and I want there to be a surprise like that at my funeral. One that makes everyone's heart go fast, so they remember their heart is still going, so I want you to have a balloon and Dad to have a balloon and I want you to pop them at different times. Okay?
Millie said when her mum didn't answer.
Go to your room,
her mum said eventually. Millie did as she was told and sat on the carpet next to her bed. She made patterns in the carpet with her fingers and watched the world upside down through her window by lying on her back with her head hanging off the side of the bed. The ground was the sky was the ground, and the trees grew downward. Everything seemed a little freer in that upside-down world. When her dad came into the room, Millie was looking down at the patterns she'd made in the carpet with her fingertips. Tiny roads for tiny people.
Why, Dad?
She said. Her dad picked her up and sat her on his waist, like he used to do when she was the littlest she remembered being.
It's just a rule, he said. You can't talk about it.
Yes, but who said?
He shrugged.
God?
But God kills people all the time. That's what Mum said.
So maybe it was someone else. The same guy who made the rule that you can't point at people and laugh. Or walk into the post office without any trousers on. There's some guy making rules that we all need to stick to. Got it?
I don't like that guy.
Her dad laughed.
We all don't like that guy.
A few weeks later, Millie sat on a green plastic chair in her neighbour's shed. She remembered it was green because she tried thinking only green thoughts while she was on it. Grass, trees,
frogs,
the garbage bin, their couch, the stuff between her dad's teeth sometimes, the stone on that lady's ring, that beer can, her pencil case. Her dad was there, and all the man neighbours were there, and her mum was there, and all the women neighbours were there. The man neighbours and her dad had scarves on and beers in their hands. And her dad had a beer cosy that had a map of Australia on one side and a lady in a bikini on the other side. And they all said very loud things about goals and tags and half-wards and wings and umps and squares. And they surrounded these words with other words you weren't usually allowed to say. But today, for some reason, you could say. Like fucking and shit. And who's that asshole? And fuck, are you fucking kidding me, you bastard? The woman neighbours and her mum floated in with plates of food, weaving in and out like slow dancing, and said, See how he talks to me? And do you want sauce, love? And get your hand off it. Her dad was loud and her mum smiled a lot, and both of these ways of being were not usual. While the kids outside yelled, "You're it! And you cheated! And you're not my best friend anymore!" Millie sat in her green chair and thought, "Celery, cucumber, avocado dip." And again, Millie felt like there were rules in her neighbour's shed, rules she didn't know but that everyone else knew. Rules that were about how men, women, and children acted around one another. Rules that gave men a spot in the shed in front of the telly, that gave women the spaces between them, that gave children the space outside. Big men dressed in the same clothes as one another stood side by side on the screen, mouthing, "Australians, all let us rejoice!" The camera swirled around the ground. It was so big it didn't seem real.
"I'd die a happy man if I was there right now," her dad said, above everyone else.
Her dad and the man neighbours laughed together. But Millie could hear only his voice, those forbidden words, like skipping stones, skipping across the surface of everything else.
"Can you die happy?"
she whispered to her gumboots.
Carl the Touch Typist. Evie worked some afternoon shifts at the department store before she became ill. One night over dinner she said, "Did you ever dream of being locked in a department store?" "Of course," Carl said. "We should do it one night," she said. "We could hide in the men's change rooms while everyone locks up. No one ever checks them." She grinned at him mischievously. "Men don't try things on in this town." They took turns to say what they would do once the event had been orchestrated. "Jump on the beds," she said.
"Eat all the chocolate," he said.
"Try on all the lipsticks."
"You don't need to wear lipstick, love."
"Type on all the fancy computers."
"You don't know how to work a computer."
"It doesn't have to be on."
"I'd take off all the keyboard letters and make a love letter for you."
"Oh, love," she said, holding his hand across the table. "But we're not vandals."
"Maybe we are," he said. "Maybe when we're locked in a department store together we will be."
There seemed a promise of an alternative version of themselves in that department store fantasy. But they never did any of these things, because they said a lot but didn't do a lot, and they were both okay with that. So when Carl, the touch typist, escaped from the nursing home, he walked straight to the department store and waited for it to open. He sat in the cafe and held his coffee with both hands. It steadied him, having something to hold like that. He watched people with lives and futures and loves, and he felt like he was floating above it all, like all these feelings that people had were beyond any experience he could ever know. And then at 4:30, he wandered into the men's change rooms and waited. It worked, just like Evie had said it would. So he stayed there every night, sneaking out of the change rooms after the lights went out and climbing into one of the display beds for as many hours as he dared. Every morning, he walked the mile along the coast to the local campground, snuck into the showers, washed himself, then walked the mile back to the department store. In the afternoons, he sat in the department store cafe, looking into his coffee cup and thinking, "Eat chocolate, jump on the beds, make a love letter for you." And then as the clock struck 4:30, Carl would begin the process all over again. He was there almost 3 weeks, and had managed to carve out an existence for himself that was tolerable. No one had recognized him. No one seemed to be looking for him. There was a slight hiccup of Stan, a short, ferocious-looking man who didn't say a lot, and the security guard with whom Carl was familiar from Evie's time in the store, but it turned out Stan was the security guard for the entire town, that he only worked at the department store once or twice a week, and when he did, he mostly sat in the office, in the back, watching reruns of 80s television programs. Carl began to think he could live out the rest of his days here, that it would be a nice way to do that. He had everything he needed. He couldn't think of a single reason to leave. And then just Millie arrived, and things became more interesting, more complicated, more hopeful. On her first night, he stooped behind the racks of maternity wear and watched her look out the window to the deserted parking lot. He watched her wander back to the women's underwear section, and it was then that he decided he needed to look after her. On the second night, Carl watched her from behind Manny. He was working out how to say something without scaring her, when Stan came clattering toward them. Carl panicked and shoved Manny into Stan's path. He'd only meant to distract Stan to give Millie time to get away, but he ended up knocking Stan out for a few minutes. As Millie scampered off and Carl surveyed the scene, Stan, face first on the ground, Manny sprawled across his head, Carl thought, well, Stan is a bit of an idiot. Sneaking around the department store this time is a little trickier. People are after him, people who know what he looks like. There are posters of his face, for crying out loud, and he has Manny to consider. What would Branson Spike do? So he walks Manny to the bus station and hides him there outside behind the big skip. He covers him with his purple jacket. I'll be right back, he says to Manny, patting him comfortingly on the shoulder. He visits the $2 shop and buys glasses and a new hat. Then he walks into the department store brazenly, his back straight, his eye contact challenging. But no one seems to notice him, and this is annoying. He goes to all this trouble and no one notices. Then he walks straight past the security guard, that Helen sits at the table next to him in the cafe, that the receptionist from the police station browses through magazines only meters from him, and not one of them spots him. They're not looking for him at all. If they see him, they don't care. He doesn't matter. So when he is locked in for the night, after he makes sure Stan isn't around, and after he has triple-checked that Millie is not hiding in the women's underwear section or behind the potted plant, Carl takes his screwdriver and hacks the dashes off every computer keyboard he can find. See, Evie, he says, I am a vandal. He lines all the dashes up against one another to spell out, I am here, on the cafe counter. He finds some chalk in the kids' section and writes on the cafe menu board, I am here. He pushes the tables together and arranges the salt and pepper shakers. I am here. He discovers the door to the department store office unlocked, so he wanders in and goes through all the drawers, searching for something, anything, that might reveal Millie's whereabouts. Nothing. Where could she be? Had they found her? What had they done to her? He sits on the desk and rubs his face with his hands. He considers the perfectly white wall. He uncaps his marker and writes, Carl, the touch typist, was here. In large, careful, rounded writing. In the morning, he walks the half mile to the bus station to check on Manny. You all right? He says, lifting up the jacket. Won't be forever, he promises. Just till we find Millie. Manny is okay, if a little dewy in the morning air. We just need a plan. Carl pokes his head around the corner of the bus station building. There are 5 bays with long parking spots for buses. One bus closes its door and rumbles to life. The faces of passengers line the windows. Some press their noses against the glass. Others look straight ahead. The bus reverses, and Carl stares at the faces in the windows like headshots. He thinks, wanted, missing. But then, on the back window of the bus, a sign, taped to the inside but facing out, In here, Mum! Millie! He chokes. And then with more urgency as the bus takes off, chugging up the hill, Millie! He pulls the jacket off Manny and shakes him by the shoulders. Manny, he says, Millie's on that bus! He throws Manny under his arm and rushes into the station. Excuse me, he says, approaching the counter out of breath. Where's that bus going? The lady behind the counter doesn't look at him. To Kell, she says, staring at her computer screen. Right, is there another bus to Kell? Sure is, the lady answers. Oh, great, one tick. Leaves here same time tomorrow. Carl sighs. He lays his forehead on the counter. "Excuse me, sir," the lady says. He looks up at her. She's finally looking at him. "Don't do that, sir," she says, gently pushing him off the counter. She produces a cloth from underneath the counter and wipes the spot where his head was. Carl stands on the footpath across from the bus station, the mannequin under one arm, trying to figure out what to do, when a car pulls up beside him. A very blonde teenage boy leans out of the passenger window. "Did you miss the bus, sir?" he says. The boy's eyebrows lift so easily into concern on his face. Carl likes him immediately.
"Yes," he says.
The boy nods in the direction of the mannequin.
"You guys need a lift?"
In the distance, Carl spies a police car coming down over the hill.
"Yes," he says quickly, turning his back and hunching his shoulders as if no one could possibly see through this careful disguise.
He kneels down beside the window and looks through to the driver's side. Another blondie blinks back at him, a girl this time, the same easy face.
"We're heading east,"
she says with a smile that would revive a dead person.
"Oh," he says, "I need to go to Kalgoorlie."
Her perfect teenage legs glint and shine at him from under the steering wheel.
Sir, says the blonde boy, your thing, sir."
"Oh," Carl realizes Manny is headbutting the boy in the face. "Sorry about that. It's alive."
He jiggles the mannequin and makes a goofy face, but they don't appear to get the reference. Meanwhile, the police car is only a couple hundred meters away and Carl ducks.
"Are you all right, sir?"
The boy leans out the car window, trying to get a look at Carl crouching in the gutter. Carl loves how this boy calls him sir, like he's in a suit shop.
"Yes, thank you," he says, still crouching, peering around the car, watching the police drive by. "Just lost my footing."
Carl suddenly loves being old, that no one would ever expect him to lie. It's ageism, he supposes, assuming that the elderly are as innocent as children, but he doesn't mind. It seems a fair and just thing, a reward for managing to stay alive for so long. When the police have disappeared down the street, he stands again, dusts himself off, winks at the girl and smiles at the boy.
"We're in love,"
the boy says,
"and we need a licensed driver."
Carl spots the learner tags on the windshield.
"Right," he says. "That's cool," he says. "You know I'm cool with that."
He watches their faces to see if cool is a word they use. They don't give much away. The girl leans over the boy's lap.
"We're happy to go up to Cal first," she says.
Carl nods. He points in the direction of the back seat.
"Got room?"
Carl sits in the middle of the back seat and tries not to think of the girl's shiny legs. Manny is strapped in on one side of him. A box with a blender and a toaster on the other. He leans forward and rests his hands on the top corners of the front seats. The front windows are down, and the boy and the girl have their arms out the windows, hands caterpillaring in the wind. These two have no idea what's coming. There is so much for them to know, to find out. Does Carl remember finding out that he knew nothing? No, it was a gradual process, a kind of melting down that took place over years. He thinks of the Wizard of Oz.
"I'm melting."
The girl smiles at him in the rearview mirror.
"Seatbelt?"
Carl leans back in his seat, trying to be casual, thinking of Branson Spike.
"You know," he says, "we didn't have seatbelts when I was your age."
He clicks his seatbelt into the buckle.
"All this safety stuff. It's a bit much, don't you think?"
"Whoa, sir," the boy says, turning around to face Carl, looking at him with wide eyes, as if he stumbled upon an ancient city.
"No seatbelts. You must be like, you know."
The sir is wearing thin.
"You've probably never driven drunk either," Carl adds haughtily.
"No, sir," says the boy. "Don't drink." "He's going to be a brain surgeon," the girl says.
"Yeah,"
the boy says, shrugging sheepishly.
"My baby has such a steady hand," she says.
The boy holds his hand sideways in front of his face.
"I hope so,"
he says. Carl is starting to dislike him.
"Yep," Carl says, putting his arms around Manny and the blender. "Used to drive drunk all the time." Cops expected it. He can see Manny looking at him out of the corner of his eye, calling his bluff.
What did you do, sir?
The boy asks.
What did I do?
For, like, a living?
That's past tense.
I was,
he searches for something impressive.
Who's that?
The girl says, eyeing Manny in the rearview mirror, saving Carl from disappointing them.
Is that some weird kind of, you know, sex thing?
She whispers the word sex.
We won't judge you, she says.
Yeah, we won't judge,
says the boy, wiggling his eyebrows at Carl. Whatever you're into.
Oh, Carl wishes it was some weird kind of, you know, sex thing.
Yes, he says before his brain catches up with his mouth.
Sex and all that. Lots of it.
Wow,
the boy says, cocking his head to one side, looking at Manny as though he's trying to work out the logistics.
With grown-ups, Carl adds hastily. Very old grown-ups.
We like it,
the girl says.
You know, it.
What's up with your hands? The boy says.
What's up with them? Carl says.
Yeah, what's happening there? Why are you so twitchy? You on something?
Carl looks down at the seat beneath him.
On something?
It's cool. Is that why you're headed to Cal? Looking to score?
In what?
Carl feels very confused and takes a moment to gather himself. He cranes his neck around to look out the back window and watches the black tar of the road spear out from behind them as if a magician is pulling an endless ribbon out of a sleeve. He looks at the blender and the toaster beside him and thinks about how nice it would be to share appliances with somebody. How nice to start a whole new life with nothing but the capability to mix food and brown bread.
There was someone on that bus, Carl says. I need to get to them.
The girl ogles him curiously in the rearview mirror.
Are you in love with this person?
Carl thinks about that.
In some way, he says.
Oh, she says. Old people love. That is so cute.
She turns to the boy.
We really need to get him to that bus. We'll get you to that bus. You are too cute.
Cute, Carl thinks. He doesn't know if it's a compliment or an insult.
Are you married, sir?
The boy asks.
Yes. I mean, no. It's complicated.
Why? Where's your wife?
Carl looks down at his fingers.
I am here, Evie, he types on his knees.
Port Cemetery, he says.
Oh,
the boy says. And then after a moment.
Meaning she's...
In it, yes.
Oh.
The boy turns to look at him.
Oh, I'm sorry, sir. You have such good manners, baby,
the girl says, gazing at him, the car pulling to the left. From the back seat, Carl points to the road.
You do,
the boy says, gazing back at her. You have good manners, baby. She swerves the car to the side of the road and parks it. She grabs his face with both hands, looks him desperately in the eyes and says,
Don't die. Don't you ever die.
I won't,
he says, putting his hands on her shoulders. I promise.
Say it, she says, squishing his face. Say, I'll never die. I'll never die.
He will die,
Carl wants to say, as they begin to slobber all over each other with an urgency they must have learned from the films. They're grabbing at each other, pulling at clothes and hair and lips, as if they want to turn each other's skin inside out. They're not going to stop any time soon. They look set in. The way country people talk about rain.
I guess I, Carl says, we'll just step out for some air.
They haven't heard him, or if they have, they don't care. The boy's taking his shirt off now. Do 16-year-olds normally have pectorals like that?
Well, just be, Carl points outside. I'll just let you...
He can't take his eyes off the boy's chest. It's unbelievable, like something from the telly.
Have some...
Carl touches his own chest, where his pectorals might once have been. Were they ever there?
Alone time.
Carl leans over Manny, opens the door, pushes Manny out and falls out after him. He closes the door quietly. He doesn't know why he does this, like they're sleeping children, but he does it. He picks Manny up and hauls him over to a nearby tree. He leans Manny against it and stands next to him. Either side of the road is dotted with small gum trees.
tufts of grass appearing sporadically out of the red dirt, like an adolescent moustache. "Show-offs," Carl says, pulling at the collar of his own shirt and peering in. He can feel Manny's eyes on him.
"Don't look at me like that," he says, leaning against the bark of the tree. "I'm sorry about the, you know, sex thing."
He finds himself whispering, "sex, too."
"I would never," he shrugs. "I wouldn't even know where to start."
He folds his arms. Carl can hear muffled noises coming from the car, rising in pitch.
"What do they know about love, Manny?"
The horn starts beeping, rhythmically, startling a bunch of pink and grey galahs into flight. Carl falls asleep, sitting against the tree, his arms wrapped around Manny's remaining leg. He wakes to the sound of slamming doors and giggling.
"Sir?" the boy calls.
Quick, Manny," Carl says with a rush of spontaneity. "Pretend you're dead."
He slumps to the ground. The gravel digs into the back of his neck.
"Don't worry," he assures Manny, tapping him on the foot. "It'll be fun. They'll love it."
Through his eyelashes, Carl watches them walk toward him. The boy slaps her bum, and she jumps in the air and waggles her finger at him, mock annoyed.
"Sir,"
the boy says, standing over him. Carl can feel him blocking out the sunlight, casting a shadow over his body. Carl feels a poke in the shoulder.
"Sir,"
the boy says again.
"We're ready now."
The boy grabs his shoulder and shakes him. "You should get up now, sir." Carl doesn't move.
"Is he?"
the girl says, gasping a little.
"Sir,"
the boy says, and slaps Carl across the face.
"You can get up now."
Carl feels the boy's breath on his cheek. The girl starts wailing.
"You've killed him. You stupid bastard," she shrieks. "I knew you'd kill somebody someday."
The boy says,
"It wasn't me."
And she says,
"We shouldn't have picked up somebody so old. I told you he was too old."
And Carl twitches a bit at this.
"Shut up," the boy says. "I'm trying to think. I can't think with all your yakking."
And she's hitting the boy now, flailing her arms at that chest, and the boy barely flinches. "What is he, Superman?" And she says,
"What are we going to do with the body?"
And the boy says,
"We'll have to bury him,"
and starts pulling at Carl's legs. And Carl is starting to feel really awkward now. So he opens his eyes and does a two-handed wave at them, like the contestants sometimes do on Millionaire.
"Surprise,"
he says. But he's not very confident in his delivery, and the boy drops his legs and screams, and the girl screams too. Has anyone ever screamed at him like that? He doesn't think so. So he smiles and pushes himself to his feet, wincing with the pain of having old bones.
"Just jokes, see?"
He spins around and does his best to do a little jig. It is a tense drive from then on. Carl tries to make small talk about family, weather, car makes. He reads out the signs they pass.
"Kalgoorlie, 100, not far to go now. Give way. Cattle crossing ahead."
Pointing out lone birds, roadkill, changes in the scrub, trying to vary the pitch and tone of his voice to incite interest. He tries a different approach.
"Listen, how many dead things do you know?"
"Excuse me?"
the girl says. He clears his throat.
"You know, has anyone in your life passed away?"
"Why are you asking us that?" the boy says. "Are you going to kill us?"
"No, of course not. It's just a question. When you get to my age, well, all the people you love have died."
The girl pulls up at the side of the road again and gets out of the car.
"I'm pissing," she says. "When I get back, no one better be pretending they're dead, or I'll kill you."
She slams the door and disappears into the scrub. The boy turns to Carl and says,
"Way to go, old man."
"I wasn't born old, you know," Carl says. "Young man."
He leans forward.
"Let's do something,"
he whispers conspiratorially.
"What are you talking about?"
"Steal something. Put beer in our water flasks."
"What's a flask?"
He thinks of That Was Whack, of Branson Spike.
"Knock over some letterboxes. Egg a house."
"We'd just have to clean it up."
"Don't you want to flirt with danger?"
Not really.
Carl thumps back in his seat. It's over, old man. The boy raises both eyebrows at Carl.
What do you mean?
You know what I mean. So Carl folds his arms, if that's the way he wants it. Carl looks out the back window again. The road seems different now that they're stationary. It isn't a magic trick anymore. It's so bleak in its stasis. But then something moves over the horizon toward them. A bus.
A bus? He says to Manny.
What?
The boy says. The bus!
Carl says as it zooms past them, shaking the car. He leans forward over the gear stick and plants his palms on the dashboard.
Hey!
The boy says. Carl sees the outline of a white piece of paper in the back window of the bus.
It's her! He says, turning to the boy. It's her! It's definitely her! Follow that bus!
What? The boy says. It's getting away from them. And Carl is desperate, so he tries to climb into the front seat, but the boy pushes him back and they grunt and groan at each other, but Carl can't win. He has no chance against that chest, those unbelievable pectorals, so he sinks back in his seat. And there's no sound but the sound of their breathing. Just calm down, the boy starts to say, but Carl changes his mind. He can win, he will win, and he opens the back door, and then the front door, and tries to slide into the front seat, but the boy pushes at him, and Carl grabs at the steering wheel to lever himself, but the boy tries to peel away Carl's fingertips, and it's unfair because he has all of his fingers, and he hasn't lost anything. The boy doesn't know what it feels like to lose anything, to lose everything. He doesn't know, he doesn't know. So Carl releases his grip on the steering wheel, and this boy doesn't know. So Carl channels it all into his hands, anything he's ever lost. It's all in his fingertips now, the ones he has left, and he feels it all there, pulsing down the length of his fingers. I am here! And he flicks him. He flicks the boy as hard as he can on the forehead.
Ow!
Superboy says, rubbing his forehead and looking accusingly at Carl.
Sorry,
Carl says, panting. Already regretting the flicking incident. Leaning into the side of the car, trying to catch his breath.
Seriously, man, that was not cool.
I said I'm sorry, Carl says.
Man.
The girl appears next to Carl.
Well,
she says, hands on hips.
Well what?
Well,
she says, pointing up the road. Carl walks forward. Beyond the bonnet of the car, raises his hand over his eyes and looks toward the direction of Kalgoorlie. The bus has stopped up ahead.
It's right there, Carl says.
Wait! He calls down the road, waving.
Thanks for the lift, he says to the couple. It was whack!
He grabs Manny from the back seat and slams the door.
I'm coming!
As he shuffles down the road, he hears the girl say,
What the hell is wrong with you?
He flicked me in the face, the boy answers.
God, you are pathetic, the girl says. Mum was so right about you.
Their voices drown out behind him.
Wait,
he says, shuffling as fast as is possible for him.
Wait for me.
He wishes he could break out into a run like he used to, wishes he could be boisterous and careless with his limbs. He focuses on the white square of paper on the back window.
Please don't go,
he whispers. The couple drive up alongside him, and Carl's jacket is thrown out the passenger window. It hits Carl in the face. The couple speeds off, fishtailing in the gravel on the side of the bitumen, a cloud of dust settling over him. Carl removes the jacket from his face and watches the couple drive off into the oblivion of youth. He takes a deep breath and yells at the top of his lungs,
He will die, you know!
Millie Bird. The bus driver is a woman, but she looks like she's wearing her dad's clothes. Blue shorts, a collared short-sleeved shirt that's too big for her, socks pulled up to her knees, black lace-up shoes. She's very skinny, with spiky hair. Millie walks down the aisle, bringing the mannequin's leg with her. The truth of Splendid